Well, good afternoon. We want to continue today with the discussion of understanding Israel. Obviously, this is deep in my heart because I think it's something that is so misunderstood, especially in the Messianic circles today, that this word has got to get out. And I was a little bit pleased this week. I got a call from Scott Diffendurfer, and he had said that he had looked on our website and seen some of the stuff that we're putting up there, and he was sort of interested in that. So I think I'm going into a little bit more detail on some of these things than what Batya had gone into. And so I think they're looking for some expanded stuff on some of this stuff. But anyway, it's not necessarily all right, but at least we're working on it. And if anybody sees any problems with it, we'll just edit it as we go. Well, as we talked about just a few minutes ago, we do believe that we are living in the end times because we see major developments throughout the world. The stock market crash last week, even though it rebounded, it got everybody, especially myself, a little bit in an anxious situation. We're seeing the rise and fall of nations around the world. And we're seeing, obviously, Israel struggling with survival over in the Middle East. We just don't know really what's happening. And it's something that we're always wanting to keep our eyes on. But as Christians draw close to Israel, I mean, Christians right now today are tending to draw closer to Israel. Honey, would you give me the little clicker over there? Christians are beginning to draw closer to Israel more and more as we see it's getting closer to the end of times. And they're sending money and food and moral support, and sometimes we got young men who are wanting to go serve in the Israeli military. Christians seem to be having this attraction to Israel, while on the other hand, we're seeing many Jewish people in this country voting for people whose policies are opposed to Israel. Why is that? Why are we having such a difference between the Christians and the Jews? And why is it that we're seeing this draw of the Christian people toward the land of Israel and the Jewish people? Well, I believe that we can take and begin to understand this more as we begin to see more clearly who we are as a people and who Christianity is as a people. And Christianity pretty much doesn't understand, I believe, they don't understand who they really are. But I think if they were to take and get a good grasp of the book of Hosea, then they could begin to understand more of who they are. And as such, they will understand why they have this desire to turn to Israel at this end time. So we're going to study the book of Hosea today and go through many of the major passages in that book to sort of understand more of not only what's in tune for Israel or in store for Israel, but what is in store for us today, people who call themselves Christians. A little bit of background on the story or the book of Hosea is that the book of Hosea spans about a 70-year period of time. And it's during the time of these kings of Israel. Now, this is the last seven kings of Israel. And if you were to open to Hosea, you would see at the beginning of it talks about the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel that it spans, and it only includes Jeroboam. But if you look at the kings of Judah that are covered, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, you'll see that Hezekiah is a king who became a king in Judah after Hosea was no longer king. So the book of Hosea covers this period of time from Jeroboam all the way through the time of Hosea, king of Israel. And as we see there very clearly, these are two different nations being spoken about. And we've talked about that quite a bit in the last two or three sessions, that there were two separate nations. Israel and Judah were separate from each other. They were not the same nation, and they even had separate kings. Now, the meaning of the word Hosea also helps us to understand what this book is about. We're going to get back to these kings a little bit later, but we'll move on here into the understanding of who Hosea is. The word Hosea means salvation, and it's spelled basically the same way that you get the word Hoshea, which was the last king of Israel. If you look back here, you see Hoshea was the last king of Israel. Well, Hosea and Hoshea are spelled the same way in Hebrew. This is important for us to realize because this book is a book about salvation, not condemnation. Even though there's a lot of mention of things that God is going to do to Israel, the overall theme of the book is salvation. And again, the word Hosea comes from that Hebrew root word yasha, which means salvation. And it's the same root word from which we get the words or the names Joshua and the names Yeshua. So it is very clearly about salvation. And the importance of the kings, there again, let's go back and look at that. It's important to understand the sequence of kings here because this in Israel, or in the northern tribes, the last king in this story passage is Hosea. Again, a term that means salvation. The last king, as far as Judah is concerned, is Hezekiah. And as we remember, we talked about Hezekiah a few months back. Hezekiah is synonymous in many ways with restoration because, remember, Hezekiah began to restore the way, the right way back to Judah. So the book ends with the concept of salvation just as the kings end with the concept of salvation, even though Hosea, one of the kings of Israel, was not necessarily a righteous king. Hosea is also a living prophecy. And what I mean by that is that God had certain of his prophets do things that seemed sort of weird. And he did that in order to clearly show the people of Israel or the people of Judah what he was going to do. For instance, Ezekiel was told to lay on his side for a certain number of days for the house of Israel, then lay on his other side a certain number of days for the house of Judah. Didn't really make a lot of sense at the time, sort of seemed sort of like a strange thing to do, but nevertheless, that's what God required of him. And then we know that also Jeremiah is another example who God told Jeremiah while he was in prison to go buy a piece of land in a nation that was getting ready to be taken over by another nation. And he did that for the purpose of illustrating the point that there was a claim on that land and that Israel and Judah in that specific case would return to this land and be able to use this piece of land that was purchased by Jeremiah. So these things are important to realize, and as far as understanding what this book is about, that the prophecies are living prophecies, and the whole concept is salvation. So let's look at this prophecy, and I'm sure some of us, or most of us, have probably gone through this prophecy before, and see precisely what we're talking about here. The very first of the prophecy begins with this passage here, when God tells Hosea to go take for yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed a great harlotry by departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. Now, one of the first things we want to see in this is try to get a little bit better understanding of the term harlot. The term harlot comes from the Hebrew word zanon. It's the Hebrew word zanon. And that word comes from the root word zana. And we've discussed this word zana a number of times because it's the word that we use or is used to describe the situation when Jacob's daughter Dinah has a consensual relationship, or at least we believe it's a consensual relationship with Shechem. It seems that because we know, for instance, that Shechem loved Dinah, we understand that they wanted to become a family. They wanted to become together. And obviously Jacob realized that too, because Jacob then arranged a formal betrothal, you might say, in that he stated, okay, if you will do this, then I will give you my daughter. And they were willing to do that. And so this would have been a legal marriage in Israel. But nevertheless, it was a consensual relationship. And this is more of what the word means than does it mean harlot. Now, there again, in all these cases, you have to look at the text or the context of what's being spoken of. But like Brad Scott says over and over, usually the first place you see the word is the best understanding of it. And the first place we see this word zana is in this relationship between Dinah and Shechem. So I would submit that instead of looking at this wife, this woman Gomer, as a harlot, it would probably be better to understand her as a basically a morally weak woman. That she's a woman that can't stay at home, all right? And she or she sees a guy and gets attracted to him, and she goes that way. But that's a lot different than being a prostitute, or a lot different from someone who's selling themselves and something else. In fact, if you get on the websites and study out this, or look at some of the writings about this book of Hosea, almost all of them will call Gomer a prostitute. But I think they get that simply from the Strong's definition without really going through and seeing what the word means. Another thing about Gomer is that her name means complete. The Hebrew word means complete. And it's as in it's a completion of a task. And this is quite in line with the whole story of Hosea, because as we look at the whole story of Hosea, and remember, Gomer is the one who plays the part of Israel in this whole relationship, while Hosea is playing the part of Yahweh or God in this whole relationship. And so Gomer is considered complete because as we go to the end of this book, we'll see that this is a complete story of Israel. It really is. The whole book of Hosea is a complete story of Israel. And not only that, at the end, Israel completes the mission that God had given, that God had given her. So as we continue on with the story, we know or we see that Hosea and Gomer got married. He was fully aware that she was a quote unquote harlot, but they got married anyway, and they had a son. And so God called or told Hosea that this is what you're going to name your son. He says, and Yahweh said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now these names mean a lot, and so we're just going to spend a little bit of time talking about these names. But this prophecy in itself is a double prophecy. It's about two different things that are going to happen. First off, let's look at the word Jezreel, and we'll see the beginning of the prophecy. The word Jezreel means God will sow. And it's a combination of two Hebrew words. First one being Zera, which means sow or sowing, and El, which obviously means God. Now, the term Zera is a term that's not just simply sowing, but it's the entire agricultural process from tilling the ground, casting the seed, watering the seed, seeing it grow, and even harvesting it. So Zera really encompasses more than just throwing out seed. And as God says, he's going to put it into the house of Israel, and he is going to sow them. Well, it doesn't say that here, but that's the implication. He's going to sow Israel throughout all the nations. And he does that by first putting an end to the house of Israel. If we need to understand that God is going to sow Israel, God is not going to destroy Israel. He's going to destroy the kingdom of Israel. Israel will no longer be a kingdom, but he's going to sow the people throughout the nations. And we can refer to Amos 9. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. God sifts Israel throughout all the nations. That's the connotation of what's going to go on here. So Jezreel, number one, means God will sow. But this first prophecy includes more than just sowing. Another prophecy is that in just a little while, I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. Now, this is an interesting part, and practically every study of Hosea that I've read before, they sort of bypass this portion of it because it's a little bit hard to understand what goes on here. But all we have to do to really understand what this is about is to study King Jehu and what King Jehu did. King Jehu was the second king after King Ahab. When King Ahab died, Ahab's son was raised up as king. And let me just see something here. Yeah. After Ahab died, his son was made king. But God had already told Ahab that Ahab, because of Ahab's wickedness, that his dynasty, you might say, or his descendants would not continue to serve as kings of Israel. But Ahab, right before he died, he repented of all he had done. And God said, okay, because you've repented, I'm not going to bring this calamity upon you, but I'm going to bring it upon your son. And so this is precisely what happened. While Ahab's son was king, God went and told or had a prophet go tell Jehu that Jehu was going to become the king. In fact, they sent he had Elijah go take and anoint one of the prophets, or I think it was Elisha actually, go take one of the prophets and told him to go anoint Jehu as king, even while Ahab's son was still king. Sort of the same thing that happened during the reign of King Saul. God had David anointed while King Saul was still king. So Jehu knew he was going to be king, and so God gave him a commission, and that was to take and kill or eliminate all the descendants of Ahab from ever being a king over Israel. And the way he did that was that Jehu went through and he killed all 70 sons of Ahab. Yeah, he killed all the 70 sons of Ahab. But the problem is, oh, here, I need to switch gears real quick. Let's go to here. Okay, so, and the problem is, though, is that Joram, who was the son of Ahab, once he killed Joram and killed the 70 sons of Ahab, that was the end of the responsibility that Jehu had. Jehu was sort of like Assyria. You know, God told Assyria that they were going to be the rod of his anger. Well, this was sort of what Jehu was. He was the rod of anger against Ahab. Jehab went further, though, than just killing the 70 sons of Ahab. He killed Jezebel. He saw to it that Jezebel was killed. And then he went out and he destroyed and killed all the inhabitants, or all the associates, I better say. He killed all the associates of Joram, who was Ahab's son. He killed all of his associates, all of his friends, all of his captains, everybody. He was only given the charge to kill the 40 sons, but he killed all of these other people. And not only did he do that, during this time that Joram was king, Joram became friends with the king of Judah, whose name was Ahaziel. And Ahaziel came up and visited Joram. And because of that, because of this alliance between Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehu took it upon himself to say that was not good either. That was an acquaintance that should not be allowed. And so Jehu goes out and kills the 42 brothers of Ahaziel. And this all pretty much all takes place in Jezreel. So when we look back here at this here where it says, in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, what that's basically talking about is he is going to punish Jehu for what all he did in Jezreel. And he does that by what happens next. And that is, in this last passage here, it says, on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now this is another story here that we need to think about. Before that, I need to back up here a little bit. One of the things about Jehu that we need to understand is that Jehu, even though he went through and killed all of these people and basically did it in the name of God, he also went through and burned down all of the altars of Baal, got rid of all the altars of Baal, burned down all the groves. He took and killed all the priests of Baal. He basically eliminated Baal worship in Israel. And for that, God told Jehu that his sons would reign over the throne of Israel, reign on the throne of Israel for four generations. And so that is what leads us up to this next point here, and that says, on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And what happened here was that there was another king. Let me go back here. It says, during the reign of King Jehoash, which was the grandson of Jehu, so in other words, he was the second king of this four-king dynasty, Elisha the prophet went to Jezreel to King Jehoash and told him to shoot an arrow out a window and shoot the arrow towards Syria. And so that's what he did. He shot the arrow towards Syria. And then Elisha told King Jehoash to take an arrow and beat it on the ground. And so King Jehoash took this arrow, he beat it on the ground two times. And then Elisha got upset with him and says, why did you only beat it two? And the reason he wanted to beat it more than just those two is because the number of times that he beat the arrow on the ground was the number of times that Israel was going to be able to repel Syria. You understand what's going on there a little bit? All right. So this, but by beating on the ground then with an arrow which goes into a bow, the concept here is that this beating of the arrow provides you basically a divine protection, you might say. And so Israel was able to take and fight back the Syrians twice because of this prophecy that took place in the time of Jehu's grandson, Jehoash. So this is the bow of Israel that's going to be broken. This basically what it's meaning is that I'm going to break this bow of protection or this divine protection that I'm providing for Israel that was brought about in the Valley of Jezreel. So all this thing goes back to the Valley of Jezreel. So it's a long explanation for a short passage, but there's a lot tied up in this whole passage as to timing and when all of these things are going to take place. So going back to the beginning, it says, the big point we want to realize in this is that this first son's name is Jezreel, which means God's will sow. And rest of this is basically an explanation of when and why all of these things are going to take place. So the next prophecy in here is the prophecy starting in verse 6. And it says, turn over to it. And she conceived again and bore a daughter. And then God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. And in this case, Lo-Ruhamah means no mercy. And it's because God was not going to extend mercy to Israel anymore. He was simply frustrated with Israel. And because they had no mercy, when time came for Israel to be taken into captivity, they were basically just swept away. I mean, it just happened almost overnight. They were just swept away as a people. There were two stages of this, but in the second stage, they just the Assyrians just came in and basically just wiped out Israel, and they took them all to Assyria, from which point they scattered on to different places. But right after it says that Israel would have no mercy, it goes on to say that Judah would continue to have mercy. And if you understand what's going on at this time frame, you're going to understand that that Judah really was going to have mercy if they were going to continue. And the reason why this is that at the time that the northern tribes were taken captive, during the time of King Hoshea, King Hoshea was paying tribute to Assyria. But at that same time that King Hoshea was paying tribute to Assyria, so was the last king of Israel at the time, I forget his name, Ahaz. King Ahaz was also paying tribute to Assyria. And as long as they paid tribute to Assyria, Assyria basically left them alone. But eventually the king of Israel, Hoshea, ran out of money. And so when he ran out of money, he stopped paying tribute to Hoshea, or to the king of Assyria. And that's when the Assyrian king came in and took them all away. But remember, at this time, in the southern tribes, Judah was still paying tribute to Hoshea, or to Assyria. But not only was Judah paying tribute to Assyria, in other words, they were counting on the Assyrians to take care of them instead of the God of Israel. At that time, King Ahaz was also introducing child sacrifice into the religious system. So it says in Jeremiah 3, verse 8, it talks about Israel being given a bill of divorce, but then it goes on to say that Judah did even worse than Israel. Well, this is the worst that Judah did, and that is that Judah initiated or instituted child sacrifice into the system. So that's why I believe that Judah, it's one of the reasons why Judah was given mercy. Otherwise, I mean, they were so bad. So going on, it says, this is the third prophecy. Now, when she had weaned, that was when Gomer had weaned, Lo Ruhamah, no mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And then God said, call his name Lo Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. So Israel was no longer a people. It means that they were no longer a kingdom. They were still people. They were just not a people. They were not a united people. They were scattered throughout the nations. Still Israelites, they didn't die off, nor did they become a part of Judah, as some people would say. They simply were scattered throughout the nations. This passage continues on and says, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered, and it shall come to pass in the place where it was said, you are not my people. There it shall be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. Then the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together and appoint for themselves one head, and they shall come out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Yahweh will continue to increase Israel, according to this prophecy, just as prophesied by Jacob, when Jacob told the sons, his grandsons Ephraim and Manasseh, that they would become as the sand of the sea. The Israelites, or the northern tribes, did not cease to be Israelites. They continued on, but again, they were just simply scattered throughout the nations. And as this prophecy says, just as in the same place where these prophecies were given, which was basically in Samaria, they would again be recognized as the sons of the living God. So what God is saying here is that even though I'm going to cast you off and sow you throughout all the nations, you will eventually be drawn back to this place. You will recognize who you are, and you will once again be called the sons of the living God. Now, to complete this major portion of this prophecy, we have this passage here. See, Gomer, even though she was married and she had these three children, Gomer eventually went off with another guy. And it says later then that God said to Hosea, he says, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as Yahweh loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods. And so what Gomer did, or what Hosea did, is he went and found Gomer where she was living with this other fellow. And he goes and actually has to buy her back. He gives a certain amount of silver and a certain amount of barley seed for her. And he buys her back. And then he tells her to come home and stay with me. And that for many days we're not going to have relations. We're not going to have the intimate with each other. But you're going to come home. You're going to stay with me. I'm going to take care of you. And you're going to be remain as my wife, though in technical sense she would be considered a put away wife. But they still remain together. If you keep in mind that Hosea is playing the part in this prophecy of Yahweh and Gomer is playing the part of Israel, then we can see, and God clearly makes this relationship right here in this prophecy. This is about God having mercy on Israel and being willing to bring her back, even to the point of giving something important or something valuable to him, giving that up in order to have her come back. And if you notice in this passage here, God doesn't tell Hosea to go get Gomer and bring her back and stone her. Gomer, stone her. Don't bring her back and stone her. He doesn't say, go get Gomer and file a divorce, give her a bill of divorcement or anything. He says, go get Gomer and bring her back to your home and then tell her you're not going to have relations with her for a certain amount of time. Doesn't say how long that is. So from this so far, and this is basically the bulk of this prophecy, but what we can see from this prophecy is that Israel was scattered, Israel's going to be drawn back, and as we'll see, Israel's going to be united with Judah, and they will appoint a king together as a united kingdom once again. And the rest of this prophecy, or the rest of the book of Hosea, is pretty much his commentary on what we've talked about. But we need to look at some of this commentary because it helps us to understand who these people are that are actually playing this part now in these end days. Because the Israelites, represented by Gomer, are a people now that have no intimate relationship with their husband. And they are a people who have been purchased back, get something of value has been given so that they could be able to come back. And as we study this and look at this, we're going to see that God, that Yahweh, has no intention of ever abandoning Israel, but instead is very much involved in the lives of the Israelite people. So we want to look at some of these prophecies now to see what this is all, how this all plays out. If we go to Hosea 2, it says, she will chase her lovers, but not overtake them. Yes, she will seek them, but not find them. Then she will say, I will go and return to my first husband. And then it was better for me than now, for she did not know that I gave her grain, new wine, and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Basically, what this is saying is that in Gomer's apostasy, or in Israel's apostasy, Israel would seek people to align themselves with. They would seek to become parts of other nations. But they're going to find out that it's not going to work. Because God doesn't want them to be a part of other nations. God wants them to be among the other nations, but not part of the other nations. They're always going to feel, Israel's always going to feel a little bit uncomfortable where she's at. Because she's not where she's supposed to be. And I would submit to you that's one of the reasons why Christianity right now is having this longing for Israel. They're a little bit uncomfortable where they are right now. They believe they should be someplace else. As this story says, eventually Israel's wealth is going to run out, and she's going to desire to return to her husband. But she's doing so because she thinks that by going back to her husband, it's going to be better for her. She was better off before with her husband than she is now scattered out. But what Israel doesn't realize is the wealth that Israel had at the time while she's out and this being scattered out while she's out there, that all came from God. Basically, what it's meaning is that God is providing for Israel even while Israel is in a state of apostasy. And that would fit just in line with the understanding of a woman who is put out. She's put out of the home. She is a woman who is still taken care of financially. So this is one of the situations that helps us to understand who these people are. Important to realize that while we're in a state of apostasy, God still provides for us in our wealth. If we move on, chapter 4 introduces the term Ephraim. We talked about Ephraim last week, and we wanted to talk about that so that we understand today. But Ephraim is the northern tribes. And some of the characteristics of Ephraim can be found in this other small prophecy in the book of Hosea. It says, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Their drink is rebellion. They commit harlotry continually. Her rulers love dishonor. The wind has wrapped her up in his wings. And they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. So it says Ephraim is associated with idols or joined to idols. In other words, they have other gods. They have pagan gods. Now, if you were to look at all of the major religions in the world, the non-Judeo-Christian religions of the world, practically all these big major religions like Buddhism, they all have one God. Practically all these other religions have one God. Now, it's obviously it's a big Buddha or something like that. Very few of them have multiple gods, except for the Mithraic religions of Greek and Rome. But Israel, and Christianity specifically, has a number of gods that they worship, but they think they're worshiping only the one God. But the reason they're worshiping other gods is because they've mixed that religion, into their own worship. And so therefore, Israel, because of their worshiping other gods and saying, this is the God that led you out of Egypt, they've introduced this mixture into their worship. So when we look at the people today that could fit the mold of Ephraim, we have to look at people who believe they're worshiping one God, but they're doing it as a mixture, and they've got all these idols attached to their worship. And I believe that we can see the great Christian religion of modern day has a number of idols idols that they put up, Mother Mary and all of these things that they worship. So Ephraim is joined to idols. This is something we can clearly see. And then it goes on to say that her rulers dearly love dishonor. The wind has wrapped her up in its wings. So this is an interesting concept too. In this passage here, this word wings is the Hebrew word kanaf, and we've seen this before, which means wings or extremities. Actually, when it says to attach the tzitzits to the corner of your garment, it actually means to the extremity of your garment, the kanaf. But a kanaf is basically understood as a prayer shawl or a tallit. And generally, prayer shawls and tallits are considered a form of worship. But what we're seeing in here is that these wings are like this. They're all over the place. And this, I would submit, is where Christianity is today. Because if you look at Christianity, they're all over the place. They're tossed to and fro. Most Christians are tossed to and fro. They can be a Catholic today, and then they can be a Baptist tomorrow. They can be a Baptist tomorrow, and then they can go to Church of Christ or something like that. Probably more likely to go from Church of Christ to Baptist. But anyway, they're just all over the place in many cases. That's why we have myriads of denominations in the Christian religion, because they're not together. They're all over the place. Whereas if you go to the Muslim religion, there's basically only three strains of Muslim, of Islam. And most of these other pagan religions, the truly pagan religions out there, they generally have just one or two strains. But Christianity is all over the place. So this is what I believe is the meaning of this when it says the wind has wrapped her up in its wings. And if you've ever been in a small airplane and you're flying along and there's a lot of wind out there, you know exactly what it means to be tossed around. because that wind will toss you all over the place in these little airplanes. So that's another characteristic of who Israel in a state of apostasy could be. Moving on, we see this other prophecy. It says, because Ephraim has made many altars for sin, they have become for him altars for sinning. And I have within him, I have written for him the great things of my law, but they were considered a strange thing. Well, here's two characteristics right at the same place. First off, when you look at altars of sin, idols require altars. Because if you're going to have an idol, you've got to appease that idol some way. And one of the ways of appeasing that idol is through sacrifice. Now, this is obviously different from the way of God, because God, we never can appease God through our sacrifices. God created sacrifices for us to be able to draw close to Him, draw near to Him, not for appeasement. But pagan gods require sacrifice for appeasement. Now, if you're a pagan, and I just use that term because it's the most, probably the easiest term to use to describe it, but if you're a pagan and you have offered offerings to these pagan gods on all these altars over the years, and then suddenly someone comes up to you and tells you that you are free, you no longer have to offer sacrifices, or you no longer have to live by a certain law, then one of the things you're going to look at is sacrifices as being wrong, or sacrifices being considered a burden, or sacrifices being a way to try to buy your salvation. And so, basically, for Ephraim, who had all these altars themselves eventually became sin for them. For if you were a Christian today and you were to support sacrifices, that's almost as bad as sinning yourself. At least that's the way it is in the eyes of most Christians. So, this is, I believe, the meaning of this concept, or this phrase here, that these sacrifices or these altars have become altars of sin. And then it says, I have written for him a great things of my Torah. The Hebrew word there is Torah, but they consider it a strange thing. And obviously we know of a religion today that believes that obedience to Torah is works or is wrong, that you should not in any way want to get wrapped up in this old Jewish law, they might call it. So there again, this is another attribute of the people that are being cast off, and the people that are basically being played out by this woman Gomer in this prophecy. Now this next prophecy will show us that Israel clearly was cast off, but still exists. It says, Israel is swallowed up. Now they are among the Gentiles like a vessel in which there is no pleasure. For they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey alone by itself. It's important to see this passage, or the phraseology that's used here. It says, Israel is among the Gentiles. It doesn't say that Israel is the Gentiles, simply that Israel is among the Gentiles. And this is important to understanding the Acts 15 conference, because Acts 15 says the same thing. It talks about the people who are being called out from among the Gentiles. So we can see that Israel was among the Gentiles. Now, besides these prophecies for Ephraim, there's some prophecies for Judah. Though Ephraim was about to be removed in accordance to the prophecies in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, Judah would remain for at least 200 more years. And you would think that Judah, when they see that Israel was taken captive, they would realize that, hey, the prophecies are coming true. We need to straighten our act up. But as we know, Judah only had very short times of restoration, and for the most part continued to walk in idolatry. While predicting the coming judgment on Israel and Judah, God says this. He says, the pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. So here we're seeing, because of their iniquity of both Israel and Judah, then they're going to stumble in understanding certain aspects of God and what God is doing. And part of the stumbling is referred to in the book of... Book of Isaiah, where it talks about the stone of stumbling, basically that Yeshua would become a stone of stumbling to the both houses of Israel. That's Isaiah 8:14. So Judah and Ephraim stumble. Judah stumbles because they don't see Messiah, and Ephraim stumbles because they believe the Messiah did away with Torah. So this is another characteristic of the people that we can see at this end time who are playing this part out. Now, there's a characteristic of Judah that's not shared with Israel that's talked about here in this passage, and it's here in chapter 5. It says, "The princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark. I will pour out my wrath on them like water. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked by human precept. Therefore, I will be to Ephraim like a moth and to the house of Judah like rottenness." Now again, these are all prophecies for this period of time of while Israel is cast off. But it says that Judah is like those who remove a landmark. There's two passages in the Torah that talk about moving a landmark, and both of them are not good. When you move a landmark, your neighbor's landmark, what you're doing is you are expanding your territory and diminishing their territory. That's an egregious sin. God does not want you to do that. He understands the importance of a person's land, and he looks at it as a very terrible thing to take someone's land. When Israel was on Mount Ebal and they were pronouncing the curses, and there's the other group of the Israelites on Mount Gerizim, the third curse that was pronounced was on those who take and move a landmark. It's very important for God that you do not move a landmark. But what was the landmark that was moved by Judah? And if we keep in context that this is about where we're at today, the landmark that was moved by Judah was the Torah. And how's that? Because Judah has added to the Torah, and by adding to the Torah, they've expanded, you might say, their territory. They've brought their law to extend over to what you eat, more so than what God said. What prayers you pray. You just look at the things, Judah has greatly expanded their territory while at the same time diminishing the territory of Israel. And when I say Israel, I'm talking Ephraim. Okay, Ephraim, Israel. They set up an oppressive set of rules and regulations. And if you were to take in, there's a passage in the Psalms that talks about the oppressed are the ones who usually have their landmark moved. The people that can't take care of themselves are usually the ones who another person will move their landmark. There's this oppressive set of rules and regulations that Judah has initiated that has done the exact opposite of what was intended. And that is, today, Jewish people, many Jewish people won't observe Torah at all because they have to apply oral Torah along with it, so they just don't try to do any of it. And in the case of Christianity, if a Christian wants to begin to learn to walk this walk, then they, according to Judah, you have to do it according to Judah's way, which includes all of these added laws above and beyond what God has given. So this, I believe, is what it's being talked about when we see that Judah has basically, as one who has moved the landmark, they have expanded their territory and very much diminished the territory of Ephraim. And it says that because of this, that God, therefore I will be to Ephraim like a moth and the house of Judah like rottenness. All we have to do here to understand this is think about what a garment does, what a moth does to a garment. What a moth will do to a garment is put a hole in a garment, right? But the garment is still usable. It just now has holes. So what it's saying here is that Israel can still be used by God, but there's going to be a lot of holes in their theology. But when it comes to Judah, it's saying it's as if it was rotten. A rotten garment is gone. You know, a leprous garment, a garment that is so filled up with all of this stuff, cannot even be worn. And so you might say that the garment of Judah is like rottenness. And what do you do with a rot garment? You have to discard it and you have to start all over again. So we're not talking about discarding Judah, but we're talking about that Judah is going to have to be re-educated in a lot of ways in order to be useful to God once again. Now, Paul talks about this a little bit in Romans 11, where he talks about the branches of Judah being broken off so that the other branches can be brought in for a period. And I believe this is what we're talking about right here. This is where the branch of Judah, because of what she has done, is basically broken off. She's not really useful for us right now. Right now, Ephraim is being useful, even though Ephraim has holes in her understanding of what God is doing. So to finish this up, we need to understand, or we want to understand, that this book is a book of salvation and restoration. And we can find restoration in the name of the first son, Jezreel, because it says that Yahweh will draw Israel back at the end of days. Hosea 2, verses 14 to 15 says, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her to the wilderness and speak comfort to her. I will give her her vineyards from there and from the valley of Achor as a door of hope. She shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt." So, just as the exodus from Egypt, Israel is going to be drawn into the wilderness where she's going to be re-educated. God's going to begin to teach Israel her ways or his ways. And Israel, because they're drawn back, because they've become the people of God once again, are going to turn to Yahweh and want to serve him more than they ever had before. And as we continue on down, and a few verses down from that, it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that I will answer, says Yahweh. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. The earth shall answer with grain, with new wine, and with oil. They shall answer, Jezreel. Then I will sow her for myself in the earth, and I will have mercy on her who did not obtain mercy. Then I will say to those who are not my people, you are my people, and they shall say, you are my God." Why is it that God, or the people say, or the earth is going to answer and say, Jezreel? Well, first off, we're talking heaven and earth today, and what we read this passage today in the Torah portion, God says, "I call heaven and earth to testify." Heaven and earth are always going to testify against or for Israel. And in this case, heaven and earth is testifying for or on behalf of Israel and saying, Jezreel. And the reason that is because, like I said earlier, Jezreel is a term that applies, means God will sow, but the sowing process is the process from casting the seed down till the harvest. And so what we're seeing here in this prophecy, that at the end, we begin to see the harvest portion of Jezreel. God has sown, but now God is able to reap. Because now at the end of days, Israel is going to be useful to God. God is going to teach Israel the things that are important to him. And then they will go out and do like the Torah portion said today. Israel is going to be living this way of life that's going to cause the nations to be drawn to her. Israel will finally begin to produce fruit. And because Israel now is producing fruit, God is going to have mercy and once again claim Israel as her people. This book ends in a very positive note, but it's a sort of a warning to us right now. God gives us this story of Hosea and this whole prophecy and this whole picture for us to understand the mind of God and to understand what God's doing with His people Israel. The last passage in the book of Hosea says, "Who is wise? Let him understand these things. Who is prudent? Let him know them. For the ways of Yahweh are right. The righteous walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them." There are those who want us to believe that Israel was cast off by God, never to be useful again. There are those who believe that Israel, at best, is going to be looked upon positively simply because of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the prophecies He made to Abraham. But Israel has a purpose. Israel is going to return, and Israel is going to fulfill the purpose for which she was called. And this, I submit to you, is, again, the prophecy, or the mystery of the ages, or the mystery of the gospel spoken of by Paul, that we need to understand, that we want to understand, because if we don't understand what God is doing with Israel, we can't understand the Scripture, and we're going to miss out on when all these things come to pass, what is actually happening in that day.